Is Obama a lizard man? Is Warren Buffett plotting to starve the world? Is the deep state undermining Trump? These answers and more on tonight's Unlikely Explanations. The answer is no. It's just no. None of those things are true. But this is not a debunking podcast. This is a history podcast. So I'm going to focus on how did conspiracy culture come to be what it is today? I first started researching this story many years ago after a long conversation with a coworker about fluoride in the water. I know, it's a great way to start a story. I showed her reports from several health organizations that discussed how the levels of fluoride in water supply are well below toxic, and how fluoride improves the dental health of an area when it's introduced into the water supply, and her response was that all the major health organizations were part of the conspiracy. She upped the ante with the claim that Jews in concentration camps were given fluoride to keep them docile. So I showed her a statement from the U.S. Holocaust Museum stating that fluoride was not a tactic used against Jews in the Holocaust, and I asked her why a body dedicated to exposing the horrors of the Holocaust would dismiss an atrocity that was real. But she demurred, and she moved on to the New World Order, and pointed to supposedly leaked emails between Hillary Clinton and Warren Buffett discussing world famine that was going to be used to consolidate political power. For context, this conversation happened in 2016. So after that, she explained to me how Donald Trump was the only person who could see through these lies. Then we talked about the hegemony of the Rothschilds through the proxy of the Federal Reserve. And then finally, we hit what I would call conspiracy bedrock, which is the claim that there are false Jews who are framing real Jews for ruining the world, who are the ones who are actually ruining the world. The question that propelled this conversation, the one I always ask when I'm skeptical, is how do you know what you know? In a world where every body of experts is co-opted, where every politician is complicit, where every intellectual is secretly a greedy cynic, where do you turn for truth? And her answer was websites and YouTube videos and fringe journalism, completely unabashedly. So, as is my way when I'm bothered by things, I started researching. I know that everything has a history, and that history has power. It has explanatory power. It provides context that isn't usually obvious when we first encounter things. And just as we can trace the progress of, say, an armored division over the course of a war, we can trace the progress of an idea through text. Any artist or writer who can restrain their narcissism long enough will tell you that no idea is truly new. We read, we think, we create, and every idea we use ultimately comes from somewhere. For example, I had equal parts chagrin and excitement when I discovered that virtually everything I will talk about in this podcast was already well explained by a professor at Syracuse University. I flatter myself to say that we independently arrived at most of these conclusions, but in truth, I surveyed the same ground that he had already conquered. I'm sure the path I took through it was influenced by the trail that he blazed. My point being, the history of ideas is just as easy to follow as any other kind of history. We mainly look at three things. One is, what is the intellectual background? Some prime examples are how Marx influenced the discussion on class warfare, and how Freud influenced the discussion on the unconscious. We know when people talk about those things that they are working within that background. Two is, what is the form? If the words have the same order as another text, and the ideas have the same order, then we can assume that it's a plagiarism or it's heavily based on another work. And three, what is the context? If we know the historical details of the writer, then we can make a good guess at what they knew and what they innovated. So when I begin to dig through the sources and look at similarities between conspiracy theories, I could follow a trail. And I found both an intellectual trail of ideas and a physical trail of evidence. The texts tell a story that follow a clear path over geography. It touched well-known historical figures, and it was surprisingly easy to follow. I say this because I'm going to get pretty deeply into politics in this podcast. I intend to keep this focused on conspiracy theory, and I don't really intend for this to be a political podcast, but conspiracy theory has been an active part of politics for the last century at least. And ultimately, the main goal of this podcast is to show how history has a way of butting up into the present. But I want to stress that I'm not here to grind a political axe. I'm going to present the facts as I found them, and I'm going to tell you the narrative that those facts tell. Now, let me loop back to that idea of context. This is the thing that I find most lacking in conspiracy theory thinking. It's been proven time and time again that we humans can find all kinds of patterns in a noisy signal. This is why we can find ghost voices in tapes of white noise, and why we can find faces when we look at rocks on Mars. It's part of what makes us so versatile at conquering the world's ecosystems. We learn very quickly, and we do so by assuming patterns from very little information very intuitively. But when we have limited information, we can make huge mistakes in our pattern recognition. It's often only when we pull back the camera, so to speak, when we get more perspective, when we get a better signal, that we get more context, that the true patterns emerge. Perhaps the most obvious example of this is with the ancient aliens theory. I know a bit about Western art, so it was pretty striking for me when I heard a very authoritative-sounding narrator on the History Channel say that beams of light from the sky in medieval painting depicted spacecraft. I've seen hundreds of medieval paintings with beams of light from the sky and never once thought it was a UFO. In fact, it's a very common way of representing divine inspiration. It's a shorthand in Western art. It's a motif. It's a meme. We can even take this a little bit further. Why would a person be sucked into the sky by a beam of divine light? Well, if you know Catholic teaching, as I do, as these painters did, you know that Mary, the Virgin Mother of God, hopped straight into heaven without passing through the grave. So we can explain things that look like alien abductions. And if we see depictions of chariots in the sky, well, we hear about chariots in the sky in the book of Ezekiel. Which leads us to the snake eating its tail at the bottom of all these conspiracy theories. Do we see chariots in the sky in art because Ezekiel saw chariots? Or because Ezekiel described chariots? So to put that another way, is revelation inspiration or is it elaboration? Are our ideas rooted in reality or in imagination? I don't know. I don't know whether Ezekiel saw God's chariot. I don't know if Ezekiel even existed. I can look at medieval painting, though, with a flying object in it, and I can say, I know where this idea came from. I can identify it. It's part of a tradition. Some ideas are testable and some are not. I can never prove or disprove whether Ezekiel saw aliens or God or a hallucination or if he was a poet who came up with an interesting idea. All I can really do is trace these ideas. So I want to stress that conspiracy theories are not by their nature false. Any number of conspiracy theories could be confirmed as true if more evidence comes out in the future. I'll discuss some theories that were fringe theories that were ultimately vindicated, and some that I think are completely and utterly debunked already. But the point of this episode is to provide context. A person doesn't wake up one day and start talking about a world order of flat earth, lizard, ancient alien people all at once. These ideas develop over time in a community. And before I totally lose the uninitiated listener, I should explain what I mean by the lizard men. David Icke is an English sports commentator turned New Age devotee who experienced a revelation that he is the son of the Godhead. The world would soon come to an end, and that most world leaders are in fact descended from an ancient breeding stock of transdimensional alien reptilians, and most of them continue to do the reptilian monster's bidding today. And if you wonder how I can say that with a straight face, it's because as a kid, my parents let me roam around bookstores for hours, and if you have kids, then you should do the same, because they might just read a book about their reptilian overlords. As someone who seeks out uncommon knowledge, my path often crosses with conspiracy theorists. I proudly consider myself a skeptic. I follow what I would call the Asimov, Vonnegut, Sagan school of American humanism and skepticism. Most conspiracy theory supporters I meet would also consider themselves skeptics. The difference between a skeptic who believes we landed on the moon in 1969 and one who does not is a difficult distinction to grapple with. So let's try and define it. I'll be talking generally about fringe theories and specifically about conspiracy theories. First of all, a theory is just an explanation for why a set of facts are related. So there's a law of gravity that says that objects will always fall in a certain way. And there's a theory of gravity that says why. And the why is because all massive bodies attract each other. A theory is simply an explanation for facts. And it can be as provable as gravity or evolution, or it can be as debunked as a flat earth theory. A fringe theory, as I'm defining it for this, is the idea that a commonly accepted explanation is, in fact, incorrect. That's innocuous enough. Every scientific theory starts out as a fringe theory by this definition before it gains support. Tectonic plate theory, which is a gorgeously simple theory, spent over a decade languishing as a fringe theory before it gained mainstream acceptance. People considered it a wild fringe idea. The important distinction is that the fringe theories I'm talking about can't and won't be disproven. Even if it would be trivial to disprove them, these fringe theories are closed loops of thinking. No amount of evidence can break through a closed loop. A conspiracy theory alleges that a group of people secretly orchestrates events. To paraphrase Michael Barkun, the New York professor that I mentioned earlier, there are three basic types of conspiracy theories. Event theories suggest that historical moments like the JFK assassination or 9/11 were orchestrated by a conspiracy. There are systemic conspiracies, where an organization affects events through secret channels. And then there are super conspiracies, which are theories that are nested inside of theories. Barkun also presents a classification system. An organization can have secret or not secret goals, and an organization itself can be secret or not secret. So a known organization with secret goals is the Freemasons. An unknown organization with known goals would be anonymous donors, like you see funding like art and museum exhibitions. A secret organization with secret goals would be something like the Illuminati. And this is the category that we are going to focus on. I want to thank Michael Barkun. His work was instrumental in the creation of this podcast, both for the history he collected and his systems for conceptualizing conspiracy theories. I reached out to him, and he was kind enough to look over the script for this episode and even answered a few questions for me over the phone. So I've included him in his own words throughout this episode.
Michael Barkun, I'm Professor Emeritus of Political Science in the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. I've written A Culture of Conspiracy, Apocalyptic Visions in Contemporary America, most recent edition in 2013. Have a long time interest in millenarian movements, and that got me interested eventually in conspiracy theories because a lot of people who have interest in the end times also have that interest in conspiracy theories, although the opposite isn't necessarily true. When I was doing research on right-wing extremists, particularly a group called the Christian Identity Movement, a particularly virulent strain of racist right-wingers, And that eventually resulted in a book, Religion and the Racist Right. And what I found, of course, was that they and many others on the extreme right were not only sometimes believers in the end times, but also were particularly fervent believers in various conspiracies, Jewish conspiracies, Rockefeller conspiracies, UN conspiracies, government conspiracies, and so on. This was what initially triggered my interest in conspiracy theories. Shortly thereafter came the Oklahoma City bombing and the interest broadly in society at large and groups like militia movements and so on. As a result, my involvement in research on conspiracy theories broadened.
Keep in mind, the word conspiracy just refers to a secret organization that tries to influence events. And that's a bedeviling thing about super conspiracies. They can absolutely incorporate factual conspiracy theories. Conspiracies happen every day. We know that the FBI dosed people with acid without their knowledge. That's provable. We know that the CIA overthrew Latin American governments. That's provable. Every coup that ever took out a government was a conspiracy before it became known. It had to organize before it took action. Furthermore, some theories are unprovable until much later, but are overwhelmingly likely. It's overwhelmingly likely that some of the UFO sightings that we get reported are actually tests of experimental aircraft by the government. We know this because we know that military aircraft are developed before they're declassified, and part of that process must involve testing them, flying them. I hope that by looking into strange stories with this podcast, I can show how strange reality really is. And I don't think we need to make up stories about this world. I think it's shocking enough as it is.
The paradigm of absolute control. And that's why we're just out here doing simple things, pointing out that we're meant to be in nature and be natural. And this is where we find the source that God made to transcend the new world order. And that's why they want to try to keep us out of it.
I'm angry. I've had enough of these people. They're a bunch of Christian murderous scum. They're on giant death factories keeping babies alive and selling their body parts. What more do you need to know about these people? I go out and face these scum. They literally crawl out from under rocks. They have green looking skin and they run around screaming, we love Satan, we wanna eat babies.
In Albert County, Georgia, there's a collection of stones about 20 feet or 6 meters in height. Much like Stonehenge and other stone constructions from prehistory, these stones function as a compass, a calendar, and a clock. They were constructed in 1979-80 by the Elberton Granite Finishing Company. Unlike ancient stone monuments, these stones do not memorialize the dead or invite religious devotion. Instead, they're inscribed with guidelines intended to help civilization recover from a total collapse. The guidelines are written in English, Spanish, Swahili, Hindi, Hebrew, Arabic, traditional Chinese, and Russian. And the stones also contain writing in Babylonian cuneiform, classical Greek, Sanskrit, and Egyptian hieroglyphic. This gives the monument additional value as a Rosetta Stone. The guidelines on the stones include Benjamin Franklin-style common sense suggestions like avoid petty laws and useless officials, international sentiments like unite humanity with a new living language, and controversial suggestions like maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. If you're familiar with the New World Order conspiracy theory, that last one should ring a bell. They urge international cooperation, balance between the individual and the state, and eugenics. They end on a surprisingly poetic note. Quote, be not a cancer on the earth. Leave room for nature. Leave room for nature. I find the Georgia Guidestones fascinating for a few reasons. To someone like me who loves the Foundation series and knows how many all-powerful empires have collapsed in the past, it's an intriguing thought experiment. This kind of thinking expresses faith in the resilience of man, a hope that even if our world system collapses completely, there will still be people, and those people will seek to rebuild or build anew. I think it expresses a realistic worldview, a knowledge that the last 500 years of European ascendancy is a fluke of history. That complexity of human society, like the complexity of organisms, ebbs and flows. It doesn't always grow forever. There will come a time when the people of the American continent experience something largely alien to us, but common to someone like Herodotus, which is living amongst the ruins of an older and greater civilization. The first two guidelines are, quote, maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature, and, quote, guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity. A charitable interpretation says that these lines urge us to avoid overpopulation and overexploitation and to cultivate a healthy genetic pool. This makes sense, given that current demography suggests that our global population growth is unsustainable and that a system of birth control will be needed in the near future. A less charitable view says that the author has a Nazi-esque worldview, where the intimate business of reproduction is controlled by the state and governed by a genetic program. And an even less charitable view says that the author wants to bring about a massive reduction in the world population and the institution of a strict eugenic program. Here are two facts we know. The author of these stones had the resources and inclination to construct a 20-foot-tall, 120-ton monument in 12 languages. He did so under a pseudonym on behalf of backers with the ability to fund such a project. That's why many people consider the Georgia Guidestones to be clear evidence that a conspiracy of people with no small means plans to unite the governments of the world and eliminate the majority of the population. This theory is the current articulation of a conspiracy theory that has been growing in America for 100 years. It is called the New World Order conspiracy theory. One feature that makes conspiracy theories different from most thought systems is their incredible heterodoxy. That word is the opposite of orthodoxy, and here I'm using it to refer to the huge diversity of ideas that peacefully coexist within the conspiracy theory community.
Is there some that are predominantly anti-Semitic? There's some that are heavily anti-Catholic. There's some that emphasize the UN. Others emphasize the Rockefellers and so on. What has been particularly interesting about New World Order conspiracy theories is that they are so flexible and so inclusive that they have room for just about everyone. And that, I think, is one of the reasons that New World Order conspiracy theories spread so widely. They really accommodated everybody.
There are popular ideas, but there are not definitive ideas. The most accepted milieu of ideas in conspiracy theory circles changes as quickly as the news does. It makes these theories particularly hardy in a certain way. There's an additive effect that keeps the super conspiracy strong, even if each of its supporting pillars are debunked. I bring this up because I just defined the New World Order as an international cabal that wants to take over the world and massacre the people. This is the clearest articulation I have, but this is not the only conception. There are many, many ideas about the New World Order. They are related to the Illuminati, they're related to Opus Dei, they are secret Freemasons, they're secret Jews, but there are camps that would disagree with each and every one of those statements. In fact, it doesn't matter who composes the New World Order. The New World Order is an organization so broad in reach and so deep in infiltration that its presence can't be detected. Or rather, it can only be detected by the canniest of sleuths. Only by stringing together a large number of event conspiracy theories over a long period of time across the globe can the New World Order be detected. Defining its exact attributes is definitionally impossible, then. It can be conceptualized in different ways simultaneously without contradiction. Even if they're not behind 9/11 and Obama, they're behind JFK and the moon landing. They are defined not by who they are or what they believe. They're defined by the evil that they cause. And because they're so hard to detect, the details of this conspiracy can shift without jeopardizing the idea as a whole. For example, let's consider Alex Jones. Alex Jones is probably the most prominent conspiracy theorist in America today. He has made statements to the effect of, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are literally non-human, that chemtrails are turning the frickin' frogs gay, that mass shootings are faked, that the government is covering up UFO events, that processed foods are designed to deplete humanity's vitality, and that HIV was created by the government to kill homosexuals. If we try to impose any traditional schema of political belief on this list, we find ourselves unmoored. He's pro-gun, he's anti-capitalist. He abhors gays, but in a strange way he supports them with this HIV theory. He's anti-vax and he's pro-UFO. He transcends politics as we know it. I understand this to be the alt part of the phrase alt-right. He was a major Trump supporter because he saw Trump as an outsider who could cut through the traditional power structures and, quote, drain the swamp. He has since regretted his pro-Trump position because of the increased scrutiny that came with his introduction to the mainstream.
I don't dislike Donald Trump. And I think he's done some good things on trying to do peace and trying to get jobs back to America. But I hate Donald Trump. Because I got behind him because I knew Hillary was bad. And then he became my identity. He's not a bad guy. But the truth is, I hate him more than Hillary Clinton. Because he's who I am now, and whatever he does is who I am. No matter what I do, they take my radicalness, my weirdness to hurt Trump, but then all it does is like radioactively attack me. I don't know how to describe it, but it's like it's like Trump is breaking my legs every day. And it's not like I'm not willing to go through the pain, except a lot of what he says I don't agree with, and he's not my identity.
I suspect that that is him reacting to the mainstream attention that Trump has brought him. When ideas move from the fringe to the mainstream, they're held to higher standards. Contradictions become more concerning, and this limits Jones' ability to jump from theory to theory freely and ignore all the times when he's proven wrong. Ironically, gaining the mainstream attention that he has demanded for all these years limits Alex Jones' ability to be Alex Jones. To quote Barkin again, the super conspiracy theories and fringe theories that I'm discussing today are defined by three tenets. First, nothing happens by accident. Second, nothing is as it seems. Third, everything is connected. I agree with this definition, but I want to point out that these suppositions are not that unreasonable. So, as for everything is connected, conspiracy theories take this to the extreme and see evil machinations in every event. However, in an increasingly globalized world, more and more things are connected. A great example of this is the Iran-Contra affair. The President of the United States secretly sold arms to Iran, a country that had recently attacked a U.S. embassy and held American hostages there for 444 days. And it used that money to fund terrorists in Nicaragua. This sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory, but it absolutely happened. Events in Iran and Nicaragua, unrelated countries on opposite sides of the world, were caused by the same secret policy. In the post-World War II world, it is increasingly common that seemingly unrelated events do have common causes. Second, nothing is as it seems. I do think that this is related to good skepticism, mostly for the reason that so much of history is only visible in retrospect, after evidence becomes public. A classic example of this is the cover-up of the danger of asbestos in the U.S. Its toxicity was proven in the 1930s, and the dangers were still being denied by the industry in the 1970s. Powers that be lie to the public often, and for as long as they can get away with it. So, sometimes we are lied to by the very people charged with keeping us safe. Now, as to that first point, that nothing happens by accident, I do have to say that's dead wrong. Any student of history should know that most things happen by accident. And I mean this in the sense of a historical accident. People do things on purpose, but the impetus that drives them and the results that follow are often chaotic. Consider Gavrilo Princip, waiting outside of a delicatessen in Sarajevo. He was a Bosnian Serb who wanted independence for Bosnians from their Austrian masters. His co-conspirator had thrown a bomb at the Archduke's car, but the car sped away unharmed. The assassination that they'd planned for months was foiled. Worse, Princip hadn't even had the chance to carry out his part of the plan. So, he waited along a side road where the motorcade was scheduled to return. The Archduke's caravan did return, but the plans had changed. He intended to visit the hospital where people who had been injured in the bomb attacks were being treated, and the decision was made to avoid the previously scheduled route in case the attempted assassins were still around. His driver had not been informed of the change, so he took a right onto the scheduled route where he should have gone straight. A driver of a car behind him shouted for him to stop. The car stopped. Princip looked up. There was the Archduke, a sitting duck. He stepped forward and shot Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austrian throne, and his wife, at point-blank range. He had no idea that his terrorist attack of rebellion would plunge the world into one of its deadliest wars. A driver makes a wrong turn. A freedom fighter takes his shot. The world descends into chaos. 22 million men die. You can't tell me that's not a terrible accident of history. And yet, this is also a great example of what a real conspiracy looks like. Six dissident nationalists huddled in a dark Sarajevo boarding house, calling themselves the Black Hand, plotting to hide weapons throughout the city to carry out an assassination. Their plans and existence were secret, but they were clear about their objectives and their beliefs. Real conspiracies limit their numbers for safety's sake and have clear objectives that draw them together. Contrast this with the New World Order idea, that society at large has been corrupted by a greedy cabal. Who forms this cabal? It's always internationalists, bankers, intellectuals, and inhuman alien monsters. This is not a new idea. In fact, this is the same idea that reshaped Europe in the 20th century. Only when this idea first came to prominence in the 1920s, the writers used a single word that encapsulated all of these meanings, and also tapped into a deep wellspring of resentment. That word was Jew. Jews have been a people apart from the societies that they lived in for most of the last two millennia. They were expelled from their homeland several times, but most significantly by the Romans in 136 CE, and they took up residence around the world. I know of no other diaspora that lived away from their homeland for two millennia without losing their culture and religion. By observing rules about marrying within the community, strict religious observance, and adherence to clothing and food taboos, Jews avoided much of the syncretism that you see between, for example, Christian and pagan religion. Instead, you see parallel communities living within other communities all around the world. In Europe, Jews often lived in separate quarters of cities and operated semi-autonomously. This structure of parallel community had significant impact on the development of conspiracy theories. And please keep in mind, I'm not trying to give you a complete history of the Jews. I'm describing a historical background for conspiracy theories. As we often see when diverse communities are living side by side, there was usually an underlying tension between Jew and Gentile that could ignite at various flashpoints, such as a crime or an accusation. This was aided by a peculiarity of law. Both Christians and Jews observed the taboo of usury, which is lending money at interest. However, Jews found it permissible to charge interest to Christians since they were not their brothers in faith. This meant that Christian communities often developed debts to the Jewish communities. Certainly, there was zero-interest banking, like we see in some Islamic states today, and there were ways that Christians covertly engaged in usury amongst themselves, which we see from the 14th century onward. It's called banking. But in much of medieval Europe, most lending came from the Jews. This created one of the biggest engines of Jewish oppression in Europe. A city would get in debt to its Jewish citizens and decide to wipe out the obligations by force In many cases, local lords tried to suppress these uprisings, which were called pogroms. This is because Jews tended to be very valuable citizens. As mentioned, they provide capital for the city, which fuels growth. They had valuable skills and often encouraged merchant trade. They were frequently better educated than most citizens, and they made useful civil servants because they existed outside of the Christian kinship system. And in that sense, they could act much like eunuchs did in governments in the East. In fact, many medieval courts had a position called court Jew, a man whose job was to finance the crown by securing loans from Jewish communities. In many ways, our current system of international banking derives from this system. And if a lord or later a government would become too indebted, well, that could be solved easily enough. Simply let their subjects do what they were going to do anyway and sanction the pogroms. Jews simply couldn't fight back in any meaningful way. They didn't have lords with lands, and they couldn't raise an army. Jewish communities were simply too far apart and too few in number to mount an effective defense against a city, let alone a lord, let alone a king. So we see this cycle repeat century after century. Jews begin to participate more and more in public life, they're expelled or slaughtered, and the local area declines. And the memory of this is still alive. If you go to Europe today, particularly in Eastern Europe, you can still hear the joyful folk tales and songs about when the locals forced all the Jews into their synagogue and burnt the hapless souls inside. In March of 1144 CE, a young boy named William went missing from his home in Norwich, England. He was found in the wood outside a town, which is today a park in Norwich, wearing only a jacket and shoes, having obviously died a violent death. By 1173, a local Benedictine monk had completed an 11-volume work explaining that William had been tortured in a sick parody of the Passion of Christ, and then killed and left to rot in the woods. The monk's sources, among converted Jews, told him that the Jews believed that if they sacrificed one Christian boy a year, they could regain control of Israel. It had been a planned attack, the text alleges. The Jewish cook at court had offered to employ the boy and led him straight into his murderer's clutches. This appears to be the first time that the Jewish community was accused of being a secret murder cult. It would not be the last time. The community was sheltered by Norwich's sheriff at the time, but at the end of the century, violence against Jews had become commonplace in England, and at the end of the 13th century, they were expelled from the country completely. I believe this case, and the countless similar ones that followed, created the intellectual framework and the language for modern conspiracy theory. The theme is repeated over and over, the suspicion that Jews are infiltrating and undermining Christian Europe. They are internationalists, they are bankers, they are intellectuals, and later in history, some are elites. There is another equally antique tradition that feeds into conspiracy theory. So around 95 CE, the Book of Revelation was written. It is remarkable for the intensity of its language and its images. It treats the visions that are depicted in the Old Testament as sort of a grab bag of phrases, ideas, and structures to draw from, often combining them without any distinction for where they came from. It describes how a horned beast will emerge, brand all the people with the mark of the beast, which is 666, blaspheme God, and battle the saints. In retaliation, God will send 7 plagues to the earth, and ultimately he destroys the world's new capital, which is New Babylon. The beast is cast into the lake of fire. Jesus returns and resurrects the martyrs, and they rule for 1,000 years. And then after this, there's one more climactic battle. There is a final judgment where the wicked people, the beast, death, and Hades are all gathered up and thrown into the lake of fire. A new Jerusalem is built, and God comes to live with us humans happily ever after. So this is the point at which Christianity basically gets its Ragnarok story. It's a startling piece of writing, and it had a huge influence on Christian thought and art. It is the last book to join the biblical canon. It doesn't appear in the Codex Vaticanus, which is the oldest known Greek Bible, which was compiled in the 4th century, but it was incorporated soon afterwards. The vein of Christian thought dealing with this apocalypse is called millennialism. The word refers to the 1,000 years that Christ is meant to reign on earth before the last judgment. The key figure for our purposes is John Nelson Darby, who was an English evangelical who lived in the 19th century. He introduced several ideas that will probably be familiar to American listeners. Based on the significance of the number 7 in numerology and in the book of Revelation, he posited that the end times would be preceded by 7 years of tribulations, during which an antichrist will establish a world government. At the beginning of these 7 years, the righteous will apparently be ascended into heaven, which is called rapture. This antichrist is charismatic, brilliant, and eventually all-powerful. And importantly, he is just like Christ. This figure is conflated with the beast from Revelations, and his followers are said to be marked with the sign of the beast. When Jerry Falwell in 1999 said of the antichrist, quote, "Of course he'll be Jewish." He was speaking an entirely orthodox position within dispensational evangelicalism. Quote, "If he's going to be the counterfeit of Christ, he has to be Jewish." I would consider these two factors, the idea of Judaism as an evil cult, and the idea of this antichrist-led end times, to be the two creators of conspiracy theory, the wells from which it draws. Now we get the inciting incident of our story. In 1903, a forgery appeared in Russia. It purported to be the minutes of a Congress of Jews, spelling out, with barefaced hubris, their plan for world domination. It was called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. In fact, it was an interpolation of earlier sources. There seemed to be two sources. So the first one comes from Polish Jews, who had enjoyed a fair amount of autonomy under Polish rule and ruled themselves through a body called the Kolal. They, in the late 1800s, were annexed by Russia. Joseph Brofman, a Jew who had converted to Christianity, accused the Kolal, this Jewish government, in a series of publications of being a subversive, infiltrating body that undermined Christian businessmen through their control of the economy. In fact, the Kolal was a sort of state within a state whereby Jews were able to support each other. And you see how these conspiracy theories take this grain of truth and turn it on itself. This body did support Jewish economic welfare, and so therefore it must be a dangerous conspiracy against Christian welfare. The second source is the text of A Dialogue in Hell Between Machiavelli and Montesquieu by Maurice Joly, a French 1864 parody of Napoleon III. So it lays out this 25-step plan to take over the world. It describes a capitalist takeover of the laws and economies of the world, which it will knit together into a single superstate of economic oppression by the upper class. And who can really blame Joly? He lived in a country where a democratic revolution had become an autocratic empire and been invaded by the monarchies of Europe, who had installed a monarch on the throne. In his lifetime, he had seen this liberal constitutional monarch, who compromised with the people, be overthrown by yet another autocrat, the Emperor Napoleon III. Autocracies defeated republican movements over and over again throughout the 19th century, and most of this was done by relying on economic and noble connections throughout Europe. Protocols linked the unrest against the autocratic monarchy in Russia to an international Jewish conspiracy. It lays out a 24-step plan to take over the world by destroying Christian morals and uniting governments and economies through control of banks and the press. We can trace Protocols' progress on a map. In 1917, a democratic revolution toppled the monarchy of Russia, bringing a sudden and humiliating end to that country's participation in World War I. That October, the Bolsheviks seized power and instituted a socialist Soviet government. For the next 5 years, the country was ravaged by a civil war between the Bolsheviks, who were called Red Russians, and the monarchists and generals, who were called White Russians. Both sides received extensive international support. In the end, the White Russians were expelled by the Red Russians. A major destination was Germany, where they promulgated the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It came to be circulated in a volume called The Great Within the Small, The Coming of the Antichrist and the Rule of Satan on Earth. Already, the Jewish conspiracy was being linked to the Antichrist and the end times. This text proved popular with nationalists in Germany, particularly for the far-right enemy of the communists, the National Socialists. It provided a palatable explanation for the loss of the Russian Civil War, and provided a powerful tool against the left wing of Germany. It was easy to tie Bolshevism to Judaism. They were both non-Christian, they were both internationalist, and they both operated outside the traditional European political sphere. It became orthodoxy in Nazi historical theory to say that Russia was ruled by, quote, Zionist occupation governments. It did not take long for protocols to be proven a forgery by the international press and academic community, but in Nazi Germany, it was instituted as part of the school curriculum. Hitler writes in Mein Kampf in 1925, "The protocols are based on a forgery," the newspaper moans every week, "which is the best proof that they are authentic." Think about that for a moment. The more that the authorities tell us this is false, the more we know it's true. It's a closed intellectual loop. New evidence cannot penetrate it. It is an unfalsifiable claim. This is the same thinking we see at work in fringe and conspiracy theories in general. What makes the super conspiracy theory so strong is that it's based on these closed loops, and they have an additive effect. Even if the protocols seems suspect, there might still be enough truth in it to prop up a larger conspiracy theory. Even if these suspect pieces of evidence are full of holes, they can still add up to something big and shadowy. I'm sure I don't need to explain the power that the protocols had on Nazi ideology. It formed the justification for the systematic oppression of Jews and made them the primary scapegoat of Nazi power grabs. The climax of this policy was the extermination of peoples considered Untermenschen by the Nazi regime, including 6 million Jews and 11 million others, including Soviets, Poles, Serbs, Slavs, Catholics, disabled people, Freemasons, Romani, and homosexuals. Erich von Dern-Boczalski, a Nazi leader who earned leniency in the Nuremberg trials by testifying against fellow party members and was later imprisoned for political murders that took place before the war, wrote the following. "I am the only living witness, but I must say the truth. Contrary to the opinion of the National Socialists that the Jews were a highly organized group, the appalling fact was that they had no organization whatsoever. The mass of the Jewish people were taken completely by surprise. They did not know what to do. They had no directives or slogans as to how they should act. Never before has a people gone as unsuspectingly to its disaster." Most super conspiracy theories purport that when you strip away the layers of international conspiracy, you reveal a rotten Jewish core. In more recent formulations, Jews are placed one or two layers out, but they're usually close to the center of evil. In my experience researching and writing this episode, I found that when you strip away the layers of conspiracy theory, you reveal a rotten anti-Semitic core. Now that we've traced the progress of the protocols of the Elders of Zion across Europe, let's rewind the clock a little and trace another arm. Protocols made the leap across the ocean largely due to the work of one man, Henry Ford. And that's where I'm going to split this story. I wrote this episode as one continuous story, but it grew in the telling, and then the interview with Michael Barkin allowed me to expand a lot of my commentary on contemporary politics towards the end. But you now have the conceptual and historical framework for conspiracy theory. In the second half, we're going to talk about its growth and development in America, and how conspiracy theory affects us today. So, keep an eye out for the rest of this explanation in May.
In a room, vampire pot, then a goblins are hobbling round, coming after us. My spirit gets close to that evil, and I fear to go.
We're such self-centered crap. We don't even notice that it's half rising up against us.
Millions of pointed people